Welcome to the afternoon, everyone. My name is Valerie Piper. I'm going to be moderating this next panel on case studies on the arts and economic development. I'm currently serving as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Development at HUD, and I'm very pleased and privileged to be here with you today. We're going to be hearing from Rich Maloney on funding for the arts to stimulate economic development in the Adams Grant Program in Massachusetts, from Lauren Schmitz on tax districts buttressing revenue growth for budding arts organizations in the Denver region, and Jenny Schultz on art galleries contributing to neighborhood transformation in Manhattan, all of which are the kinds of studies and topics that have engaged people in my field for a number of years, and I thought actually were really useful counterpoints to some of the papers that we heard this morning. So I'm very excited to hear this discussion, and I have been told that I have 3 minutes to do an introduction, so I don't get to go into any detail. We're going to save that for the Q&A later. But welcome, everyone. And Richard, do you want to come on up first?
Hello, everyone. Just want to thank the NEA and Brookings for giving me the opportunity to participate here today. And I want to recognize my co-author, Greg Wassel, is here in the audience as well, and some esteemed colleagues from American University. My topic, obviously, is a little bit different than what you've heard earlier today for the most part. It's a little more direct, a little more applied. But my interest is in small cities, towns. I have struggled for a term for this. I was thinking of like average places. Regular is the other term that I use a lot. Regular. Spent like 3 years trying to define regular and failed and had to go in a different direction. So I'm looking for basically cities and towns that are not the central cultural producing place in their region. I'm looking for some of these outside cities, maybe bedroom communities, things like this. And so I'm saying as cities and towns have struggled so much to find ways to increase revenues, we see a lot of interest post-Richard Florida, to evoke his name again, to try to find ways, different ways of generating economic development fairly effectively and inexpensively. And so a lot of places have been talking about the arts. So we do know some things about how some of these programs work in globally, large cities, large countries, about culture, but there's not as much we know about how these types of things actually work on the ground in smaller, quote, regular communities. So the question, I got very excited about this and tried to figure out a way that maybe I could look at how this might work. So I became very interested in the process of it. And so then I finally said, well, why don't I just go ask somebody? So but I needed a framework at first, and so I said, "Well, how do you believe that a community is really trying to do something with cultural economic development?" And I mean, sure, you could go to somebody in the town or the town manager, and they'd say, "Oh, yeah, sure, we're doing that, we're all over that." But I didn't really know how to start. So, fortunately, the Adams Arts Program grant was created in Massachusetts, which gives grants to communities to do cultural economic development. These are not enormous grants, but the program has been ongoing for some time, maybe not long enough to really show a lot of large-scale results that are measurable, but it has been ongoing. And so I decided I would use this as kind of an indicator of serious intent by a community to be engaging with an initiative in cultural economic development. So I sort of started looking at this, and I said, well, certainly certain places would apply and other places wouldn't. And so I found out that people applied from everywhere. And so I ended up with the kind of Lake Wobegon phenomenon of, I was saying, you know, is every place above average, culturally speaking, you know? So everyone said, oh, yeah, we have tons of culture in our community. So I needed to get to the bottom of it. I said, that can't possibly be true, but everybody's the same. Let's take a look at this. So I needed a little bit of a framework. So I start out with some questions, and I have three questions that I looked at. Today I'm focusing primarily on the second question because of time and space. But I wanted to look particularly at, you know, what were the elements that went into creating and sustaining these policies that were established in these communities. So I needed to pick some community. So I decided to look for state of Massachusetts because of obviously these were impacted by the Adams Arts Grants. And I looked at some cities and towns that were 30 to 50,000 people and had received Adams funding for at least 3 years, including 2009, which is the last year that I was looking. I did through 2009, 2010, I did this for the study. And because I was interested as a public policy person, and I was interested in kind of government engagement with local government as well. So I put that as a factor as well, that I'd want to pick a town that had government participating in the grant just to see what kind of role they played in this partnership. All right. So I think Stephen mentioned Pittsfield showed up on some of your graphs as being, and I said, I know Pittsfield, I wanted to do that one really bad. I know that was the one that would be there. But I almost suspect Pittsfield would look like a little bit like Hyannis, a success that, and so they look good right from the beginning. I looked at Hyannis, Gloucester, and Fitchburg. Pittsfield fit that category as well. They fit those three categories, but I just didn't have time to squeeze it in. But I probably will do that within the next year and just do it by itself. So I did a lot of small text. Sorry. And then that was the easy part. So I interviewed a bunch of experts in the community. Each of these experts were drawn. The grants were fabulous because I looked at all the grant proposals. I looked at their goals. I looked at their objectives. I looked at how much money they got. I looked at all the people that supported and signed on to support their efforts. I looked at all the partners that signed on to support these efforts. So I had some real, you know, people on page saying, yes, we will do this. That was a good place to start. So these respondents came from these lists of people that were engaged in the process and knew about it and were part of the writing of the proposal. So I knew that I was going to be talking to people that had a good sense of what was going on with these things. I made it anonymous so people could say, you know, the town, they really screwed that up. You know, I tried to make it so that people wouldn't feel afraid to tell me what was going on with the process. In the end, I spoke with people in the public and nonprofit sectors. I was hoping to get a little bit more into the business community, but for various reasons, you know, there wasn't an exact balance in each community. You know, they didn't say you have to have two people from here, two people from there. You know, it's just whoever signed on to support the project. They did encourage the nonprofit and the town and business to work together. That was part of the idea that this would be a grant that would not be allowed. The arts organizations by themselves couldn't apply for it. They had to apply for it in partnership with the town or with the business or with other community partners. So again, it gave a chance for people to kind of get more engaged, though I wasn't able to get the exact same balance of people interviewed in each of the communities. Again, very small. I just put this up here because I wanted to, these are, you know, taken out of the actual grants. There's a list of partners. There's a list of some of the funding, total funding, project descriptions, and project goals that are down here for Hyannis. But I'm going to focus more on the process than the actual specifics of each community today because of time. Again, you can see a wide range of partners. And then here, economic development goals, a project summary, and the history of funding that's also up there. And again, for Fitchburg. So, the findings. This is something that Greg Wassel and I were kind of working on, and he was doing some work, and we have a lot of, it took us a while, but we've developed a lot of quantitative data as well, which is going to take us a lot longer to work through. But at first I was saying to myself, well, you know, does everyone look the same? Did people who applied for the grant, do those communities look the same as people that didn't apply? Right? And we found out that if you did not apply for the grant, your percentage of high school graduation rate was higher, your college graduation was higher, your family income was higher. So what we might have thought initially was, well, people that would apply for this would be communities that had lots of arts lovers in them. And a lot of the people that attend, you know, we've seen today, you know, graduate degrees, high income, those are people that may traditionally attend the arts. But those communities where those people live did not apply for grants. The places that applied for the grants were communities that were much more struggling in terms of their college graduation rates, their income, their population was larger. They were communities that actually did not, that were quite different in those regards than the people that did not apply, which is a bit of a surprise to us right away. Then we did this cultural density kind of thing, which actually Anne had done something very similar to just a few minutes ago. We said, well, what about do the places that have, maybe these places that didn't apply, maybe they have tons of art and they don't want it, they don't need it. But it turns out that the places that people that applied for several grants at the bottom actually have more cultural nonprofit assets and spending per person than the places that did not apply. So again, we were a little bit surprised by that. So to get into the kind of the meat of the answer for the policy process is these four factors right here I found were really crucial to implementing these kind of, whatever the project was. These four factors were crucial in creating these programs. So, first, vibrant community partnership. With, you know, community leaders, local leaders, arts leaders, business leaders, education leaders, all these kinds of people were involved in the partnership. These leaders had very large personal networks. They cared deeply about the arts, but also very profoundly about the community. So it wasn't just that they were arts lovers. They loved their town, right? They wanted to help their town. And they were very interested in the local quality of life, right? So one thing that we found out, one thing I found out along the way, is that while I would come in talking about economic development, people would start steering me towards community development. Or they would say, oh, that's all very well and good, but what we really love the fact that we see people more on the streets, you know, or we see the downtown looks better, you know, and people are come up to us and say they love that festival for the kids. You know, so there's this feeling that, you know, they would say, oh, that's nice, economic development, that's what we applied for, but we really love these other, what I call sometimes soft ED, you know, quality of life issues also come out. And, you know, I think I have this in another slide, not to go out of order, but it's not surprising because community leaders and arts leaders and education leaders are not economic development officials, you know, officers. They are care about the community in a very broad way. They're not specifically or narrowly trained in economic development. I mean, I did talk to economic development people that were running the initiatives, but that would be one person in a town out of 20, you know. So other people had other reasons for being involved. All right, we needed an intermediary organization. We've seen this in other economic development literature, the importance of this. Managing the process, linking the artistic community to government to help overcome misconceptions. Because local government and the arts, it is true, I'm here to tell you from field experience, they do not understand each other all the time. So as I said last night to some of the other people on the panels, I said one town official, you know, kind of leaned over to me at one point and said, you know, it's hard to work with artists because they have very difficult personalities. They don't understand business or how to run a business. I said, oh, that's, people are saying that. So that's what they got. So the intermediary keeps these things moving along and keeps the communication going. Local government provides three different kinds of things. They provide these hard services, these kind of soft services, and the seal of approval, I call it, kind of signaling to the community that we get behind this, we believe in this, you should take a notice of this. All right, so these three kinds of things, and you can flesh those out a little more, but for now, that's good. And the thing that surprised me with the Mass Culture Council, I just assumed funding, you know, forced funding, right? That's what they're there for. But they provided a wide range of additional services to help these people get their partnerships going. So time and time again, people said it was the technical support that really got them over the hurdle, all right? All the meeting help, the grant writing assistance, the training, conflict resolution, all this stuff made these partnerships. People said we wouldn't be here unless they provided us with those services, all right? So some tentative findings. In addition to those four factors, there are a few other little things floating around. I saw the role of the media in some communities seemed to play a big part, the local newspaper. They got behind you. That was very positive. The local college, in two out of the three communities, there was a college. The college, if involved, could play an enormous role. If it was on the side, it seemed to be a non-factor. So how much, you know, how that plays across every community, I don't know yet. And this was completely off on the side, but people constantly mentioned quietly, if the public schools were only better, we would just have a much better shot at doing all of this work. So I have to leave that one alone for now, but just it was a great little side thing, because I know I'm running low on time. So virtually everybody believed that these things had made a positive impact on these communities, these initiatives, although most of them felt that changes could be made to make them better. The leaders in these efforts were overworked and approaching burnout. They were exhausted, right? A lot of them are volunteering their time. The deeper the initiatives connected to the community, the more they described it as successful, all right? So if the town hall was really involved, if the arts leaders were really involved, if the Chamber of Commerce was really involved, the college was really involved, that was great. If somebody was a weak link, everybody knew about it and felt it was tough. And as I mentioned, the eSoft goals seemed to be as important, if not more important, than what they originally signed up to accomplish. So town by town, Hyannis looked like it was a major success from all parties, a great partnership. That really was the key for them, and town government taking the lead and driving this thing home. So town never wavered. The partnership was strong. My hypothesis is, as a vacation community with an off-season, they know they have to work together or they all go down. So they had a long history of partnership and having successful arts, community, government, you know, all nonprofits, all working together in the past. This was just another chance to work together. They jumped in, they did it, it was easy. Other places, quite challenging. All right, working with artists is tricky. Local business owners have their own agendas. I was joking last night, they would say no matter how good their business was doing, when the town people came by to take a look at them, they would announce, business is awful, awful. And because they said they don't want you to cut off the support. They're loving the support from the town and the energy. And so they said they'd look at a store filled with people. The business owner would come to them and go, this is hideous. I'm going bankrupt. You know? And they said, how do we even measure this when they lie to us to our faces? You know? So Fitchburg. Businesses have moved down. People are attending the festival. The college is really helping. The young, talented mayor is very gets it, really knows what's going on. But there's an old guard there, an old guard that's used to kind of the older way down. It's a downtrodden industrial community in a way, not looking to change too much. The funding has been up and down, so it starts to go and then it fails. You know, it's not sustainable. The volunteer leaders are exhausted. Local residents don't know much about the arts. And, of course, there's many places said they have city problems, which means crime, drugs, prostitution. And this is something that takes up a lot of their energy. In Gloucester, we see there's more cultural events. They're coming downtown. They're doing art making. But in Gloucester, I don't know if anybody knows Gloucester, it's fishing and art. I don't know if you guys saw the movie, Danny Wahlberg, whatever, the boat movie, whatever. I can't remember. Perfect Storm. You know, it's fishing and art, and you've never seen a place like this where they're, like, literally fishing and art together. It's unbelievable. So, you know, the efforts are split. The intermediary organization really struggled and lost a lot of credibility, and they have city problems. And that's it.
Good afternoon. Thank you to Michael Rushton and to the staff at the NEA and the Brookings Institute for making this event possible. My name is Lauren Schmitz. I am currently a PhD student in economics at the New School for Social Research in New York. The research I'm going to present to you today examines the unique impact of a regional cultural tax district on the growth and sustainability of the arts organizations that receive annual support from its proceeds. For those of you who are not familiar with the term, a regional cultural tax district is a sales tax that distributes its revenue specifically to eligible arts and cultural organizations within its geographic boundaries. So my central research question is, do cultural tax districts crowd out private funding for the arts? So extensive literature in economics has been devoted to investigating whether government transfers crowd out or reduce private funding for arts organizations. In economic theory, complete crowding out, which has never really been observed empirically, states that a dollar increase in public funding will reduce private donations by the same amount if individuals treat their contributions as perfect substitutes for public funding. In general, the crowding out hypothesis has received a lot of attention in the economics field because it really gets to the heart of both the role of government in providing public goods and also the ability of government to increase the supply of a public good. It is typically used when referring to the efficacy of fiscal stimulus or social transfers in expanding economic activity and private investment. The research I'm presenting to you today is unique in that it looks at the effect of public support from a regional sales tax on private and earned revenues for arts organizations. Little attention has been paid to how a regional sales tax, as opposed to a lump sum tax, for example, may impact private giving and program-related revenues for the arts. Specifically, I look at the Scientific and Cultural Facilities District, or SCFD, in Colorado. SCFD is the largest cultural tax district in the U.S. Currently, over 300 organizations receive annual support from its proceeds. So as many of you in here may already know, arts funding in America is a mixture of private, public, and earned income, with roughly 43% coming from private donations, 44% coming from earned income or program or mission-related revenues, and only 13% coming from public funding. As a recent study by the National Endowment for the Arts pointed out, this mixed market system can create an environment where only the best organizations survive and new growth is fostered alongside established institutions. However, the turbulence of the American system for funding the arts can also be destabilizing, because significant reliance on private funding means that the level of donations can fluctuate from year to year. This means that many organizations, particularly those in their infancy, may struggle to gain the secure footing necessary to grow and prosper. Within this framework, what effect might revenues from a regional tax district have on private and earned revenues for participating organizations? So first, I wanted to give you a little history on the and some background information on the SCFD. In 1988, voters in the Denver metropolitan area overwhelmingly decided to increase sales taxes in the area to support arts and cultural organizations through the creation of one of the United States' first regional cultural tax districts. At the time, the boost in revenue for the arts was badly needed. In 1981, state funding for the arts had collapsed, and despite their best efforts, some of the region's premier cultural institutions were struggling to make up the difference. Jane Hansberry, the district's first administrator, notes that the 1988 vote was an extraordinary event, both because it was counterintuitive that citizens would vote for a tax increase in such bad economic times, and it was a vote to provide public support for the arts at a time when many pundits doubted the public's willingness to support culture with tax dollars. Since then, the SCFD has been reapproved by Colorado voters twice. So the SCFD is a sales and use tax of 0.1%, or 1 penny for every $10 in purchases made within the seven-county Denver metro area. This works out to a tax contribution of only $15.17 per person per year, so about the price of a movie ticket these days. The tax distributes $40 million on average to over 300 cultural organizations and has distributed over $660 million since its enactment in 1989. So SCFD funds are distributed amongst eligible organizations that are grouped into three tiers according to their size. The tier that I really want to draw your attention to is Tier 3. Tier 3 organizations include a diverse array of over 200 small organizations, with annual operating revenues ranging from as low as $10,000 to as high as $1.4 million. Tier 3 organizations reapply every year through a competitive grant process to receive 14% of SCFD funds. My analysis today focuses specifically on how the receipt of SCFD funding impacts these smaller arts organizations. The SCFD also includes Tier 1, which is comprised of the five largest regional cultural institutions. They receive the bulk, or 64%, of SCFD revenue. Finally, Tier 2 currently consists of 26 mid-size organizations. They receive 22% of SCFD revenue based on a weighted average of their qualifying annual income and audited paid attendance. What does the existing literature on crowd-out find? The majority of empirical studies on the arts find partial to no crowd-out or even crowd-in. To be brief, I listed some of the most important studies. Both Brooks and Borgonovi's research finds that the relationship between public support and private transfers is nonlinear, meaning that low levels of public support crowd in private donations, while higher levels may displace them. Smith finds the degree of crowd in or out depends on the type of arts organization. Andreoni and Payne look at the demand side of the funding market and find that the receipt of government grants causes organizations to reduce their fundraising efforts. Doko finds that private contributions to the arts increased by 60 cents for every dollar of the major funding cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts during the mid-1990s. However, this looks at the effect of a decrease in public funding, which could potentially be argued to have a different effect on private funding than an increase. Overall, this ambiguity in the crowd-out research points to the need for more specific regional and institutional assessments. A standard regression model cannot be used to directly assess the impact of SCFD funding on private giving because private giving also influences SCFD funding, so the causality is unclear. SCFD funding is awarded based on both the other private and public funding an organization receives and other variables such as audience support that are correlated with an organization's funding. To avoid this problem, I use a difference in differences estimation technique. It's a lot of differences. This approach estimates the impact of being inside the SCFD by comparing a treatment group, in this case, small arts organizations inside the geographical boundaries of the SCFD, to comparison nonprofit organizations of different types and sizes. Another way of looking at this is that the incidence of the SCFD in Colorado for over 20 years makes it possible to conduct a natural experiment of sorts. We can collect data on the organizations that participate in the tax district and compare them with comparison groups that are not eligible for funding or are outside the tax district. So to give you an idea of the geographic area that I'm talking about, here's a map of Colorado with the counties that participate in the SCFD shaded in yellow. Traditionally, the type of estimation technique that I am using would capture the effects of a policy change by comparing treatment and comparison groups across two time periods, optimally before and after the policy of interest was enacted. Since data on nonprofit organizations from before the creation of the SCFD in 1989 were unavailable, another comparison group is used in place of a time dimension. The treatment group, or small arts organizations inside the geographical boundaries of the SCFD, are compared to small arts organizations outside the district, as well as small non-arts nonprofit organizations inside and outside the district. Here, the comparison groups I used vary from the treatment group on several dimensions, but they are influenced by the same elements that affect arts organizations in the district. Mission aside, nonprofit organizations inside and outside the district are subject to similar institutional rules that govern their financing, management, and operations, and thus they respond similarly to observable changes in economic and political forces. At the same time, the differences in the types of goods and services that arts and non-arts organizations provide control for the problems of unobserved variation between the groups that can often bias results. These variations could include, for example, differences in potential private donors or mission-related differences that affect reliance on private funding. I created a unique data set to estimate the impact of SCFD funding on different revenue streams for small arts organizations. Data on total revenue, private giving, and earned revenues, and government grants were collected from federal tax returns filed by IRS Section 501c3 organizations in the year 2005 in Colorado. If the organization received any money from SCFD, that was also recorded. I used a cross-section from 2005 because it captures a relatively neutral point in the business cycle. Nonprofit revenues and donor behavior are not subject to the sharp fluctuations in national income that characterize the beginning and end of the decade. The final sample includes 527 organizations. So tentatively, my first round at the results, the statistical results show a positive impact. The results show that small SCFD organizations crowd in revenue. In my estimation, the marginal effect of being a small arts organization in the district actually increases your total revenue by $3.6 million, earned revenues by $2.17 million, and private giving by $1.6 million. For the technical folks in the audience, here's the main table of results from my research. Again, the result I really want to highlight is the impact of being a small arts organization in the district, so the marginal impact controlling for these other factors. As you can see, controlling for other countervailing factors, the impact of receiving SCFD funds for small organizations is an increase in total revenue of $3.6 million, and most interestingly, a $2.17 million increase in earned revenues. Earned revenues include any revenue generated through mission-related activities, such as ticket sales, membership dues, or revenues from fundraising. Particularly for smaller organizations, these revenues indicate community support for their mission, which is vital to an organization's sustainability. Smaller organizations also crowd in $1.6 million in private giving, though this result is only significant at the 10% level. I also control for population, race, education, income, and the percent of the population living in poverty. So why might small SCFD-funded organizations crowd in more earned revenue or more revenues? A few possible explanations that I put forth are that SCFD organizations are benefiting from a boost in public revenue that allows them to design more quality programming. It could also be that SCFD organizations are benefiting, as Richard highlighted in his research, from a potential signaling effect to the community about the proven value of their programming. For example, if you are an SCFD organization, the SCFD logo, a big polar bear, appears on all of your marketing materials. Because the SCFD grant process is fairly competitive, this may act as a stamp of approval of sorts, assigned to the community that you are worthy of support. Three, or from a perspective of the organization, since future awards are based on past performance and evidence of community reach, it could be that receipt of SCFD funds incentivizes organizations to create more mainstream or marketable programming that appeals to a broader audience. All three effects could have a positive influence on the future growth and sustainability of an organization. So some conclusions and policy implications. Do cultural tax districts buttress revenue growth for budding arts organizations? These results speak only to a specific sample and period in time. More data is definitely needed, and you know it needs to be examined in more depth, but they indicate that cultural tax districts may enhance rather than replace other sources of revenue. The result that smaller organizations may crowd in more earned revenues is of particular interest to me. For any arts organization, but especially for those that are in their infancy, high levels of earned revenue are really desirable. Audience building and community support are strong indicators of future success and financial stability. To this end, my research argues that the creation of more cultural tax districts may be valuable to the extent that they promote further growth and consequently visibility in an organization's philanthropic base. However, further research needs to be done to reinforce the validity of these results. Subjecting additional time periods and comparison groups to a similar model or using other econometric techniques to investigate crowd out would be a first step. Most importantly, this would further inform the debate surrounding not only the efficacy of cultural tax districts, but more broadly, the future role of government in supporting the arts. Thank you.
So thanks again to Michael Rushton and the NEA and everybody who's given us a chance to share all of our research. It's really exciting to have an entire day where everybody's talking about the same topic, and so we get to learn from one another. That said, I feel like I've come a very long way from the morning presentation. So this morning we heard about sort of really big aggregate macro measures of economic activity from the arts as a broad set of industries. I'm going to go into a tiny little micro level of detail and talk about one really narrow slice of the arts, and I'm going to look at very specific, geographically specific impacts of this. So do art galleries transform neighborhoods? And there's a lot of, I think, qualitative research, some case studies of individual neighborhoods that really sets the stage for this. In particular, those of you who are familiar with sort of the urban mythology of Soho was that it was kind of an industrial, blighted neighborhood, not a lot of activity going on. Then in the 60s, artists started moving in. They took over these loft buildings, transformed them into their apartments, their studio workspaces. After that, the galleries came in, and, you know, at this point, there's a Starbucks on every corner. The stockbrokers have bought up all of the lofts, and, you know, the world has come to an end. So there's sort of this, you know, and there are other neighborhoods that could tell similar stories where artists and galleries are kind of the first couple of stages in transforming particularly these sort of industrial neighborhoods into more traditional residential and retail areas. And so I'm trying to do essentially a quantitative test to see whether that's true, focusing on New York, but looking at a couple of different neighborhoods and trying to get very specific measures of whether or not they have really changed the surrounding built environment. A couple of things that are worth noting. So as a conference today, we've talked a lot about the arts and the arts industry or arts occupations. And I'm actually not sure that we want to lump them together all the time. If we're measuring aggregate impact of the arts as a sector, I think that's useful. But I think for our it's also worth it to have some studies that divide these up. We've talked a little bit about the difference between arts consumption and arts production, for instance. We've talked a little bit about visual arts versus performing arts, which are slightly different. And in particular, I'm actually going to focus on art galleries, which are for-profit entities. So most of the discussion today has been on arts as nonprofit organizations. Galleries, it's important to remember, are businesses. Their economic purpose is to sell works of art. And so it'll be helpful as we go through the presentation to think of galleries as luxury retail stores. An art gallery is basically like a Prada store. And so that will explain a lot of the results that I'm going to find here. And as everybody has said, data is difficult on this to get on this, and that's, I think, one of the reasons we tend to sort of look at these aggregate measures. So the question that I want to ask is, do galleries generate physical changes in surrounding neighborhoods? This is a different measure of economic development than we've seen before. A lot of this is because sort of the mythology of neighborhoods like Soho really is they transform the physical nature of the neighborhood, the building stock, and so I'm going to use that as my indication of change. In particular, we would think there might be shifts towards residential and retail land uses away from these kind of industrial ones, an increase in the quantity or the density of the building stock, which should tell us whether there's an increase in the underlying property values. So are they generating value to the neighborhood? The conceptual framework, or what economists would call the problem with identification, galleries decide where to locate based on the initial conditions of the neighborhood. Is this a neighborhood that has amenities or infrastructure that makes it a desirable location for galleries in the first place? But those amenities and infrastructure are likely to change the development path of the neighborhood in the future, too. So the real question is, do galleries cause neighborhoods to redevelop, or do they pick neighborhoods that have a high probability of redeveloping at some point in the future anyway? Broad overview of the study. I'm not going to go into lots of details on the empirical strategy. I'm looking at the relationship both between the physical environment in attracting galleries and then whether the presence of galleries changes the physical environment going forwards. And I use a couple of data sets that are specific to New York. So unfortunately, you can't replicate this in other cities with these data. I have a database of the name and location of art galleries in Manhattan from 1970 to 2003. I can go into more details if you're interested in how that was assembled. It was a long and painful process. If somebody wants to replicate it for another city and share it, that would be great. I also use some administrative data on buildings in New York City that comes from the Department of Finance that's used for property tax assessment purposes. So the basic empirical strategy for the first question, I try to model how galleries choose their locations at a fairly small level of geography and then determine whether the number of galleries in a neighborhood predicts future changes in the neighborhood. And so I actually have no regression coefficients to show you. I'm going to show you lots of maps and pictures. This is one of the really nice cases where the pictures essentially tell the same story as the numbers, and they're easier to digest and more fun to look at this point. So this is a map of Manhattan, and you can tell that there are very high concentrations of galleries in four neighborhoods, essentially. So the first one is on the Upper East Side, right along Central Park, and these are mostly clustered along Madison Ave, Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue. The second cluster is just below Central Park along 57th Street. The third cluster down here is Soho, and the fourth cluster over here is Chelsea. Just very briefly, some descriptives about the neighborhoods. The Upper East Side is highly residential, and it's basically old money, right? So this has been an affluent neighborhood in Manhattan since, you know, basically Edith Wharton, home to the Metropolitan Museum, the Guggenheim, big cultural institutions. 57th Street and Midtown, this is almost entirely commercial. Very few people live in Midtown. A lot of the galleries are clustered at the intersection of 5th Avenue and 57th Street, which is a hub of luxury retailers. So since 1940, when Tiffany opened its doors here, this has been where Coach and Louis Vuitton and Prada and all of the big-name luxury retailers are, and galleries are essentially part of that high-end retail cluster. Soho and Chelsea, I'm going to go into a little more detail. Soho sort of, you know, is more mixed residential, commercial, has this long history with the arts. Chelsea's the most recent gallery neighborhood, and this is, again, sort of an area that started off heavily industrial over on the fringes of Manhattan and is still in the process of transitioning quite a bit. Okay, so I'll give you the bullet points of the results, and then I'll show you some more pictures to hopefully persuade you. Gallery location choice is very strongly correlated with the amenities in the neighborhoods. Some of the strong predictors are the quality and the vintage of architecture. So I use a similar proxy that Doug has used before, looking at whether buildings are in historic districts. Galleries like, apparently, to be in pretty buildings, and I'll show you some pictures to back that up. They're attracted to neighborhoods with cultural amenities. Not altogether surprising, galleries and museums are in many ways complements. They figure if they locate near museums, they're likely to get spillover from people who like looking at art. Maybe they'll even be inspired to buy some. They're responsive to land use patterns and zoning. Galleries are commercial use. They are constrained from operating in residential areas because they are retailers, and so they have to obey that. Very, very strong predictive patterns of where star galleries were 5 years ago. So if you think about, particularly if you're an unknown gallery and you're just opening your doors, the best place to be is right next to a famous gallery, because people are going to come to the famous gallery that they know about already, and if they see you there, they're much more likely to walk in. If you're off on your own in the middle of nowhere, chances are nobody's going to come and find you, right? So this is very, very strongly predictive. Other unobservable amenities implied by price. So despite the sort of legend that galleries are looking for cheap rent, I have yet to run a regression that has a negative and significant coefficient on rent or housing prices or income. Galleries care more about the amenities than they do about cheap rent. Otherwise, they jump over the river and go to New Jersey, right? But they really care about the amenities that they're getting and the reputation of being in Manhattan, and for that, they're willing to pay higher rents. And very important note, these four neighborhoods with lots of galleries are different from one another. The amenities that attract galleries differ across neighborhoods, across types of galleries, and across the level of geography that you look at this sort of prediction. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all gallery neighborhood. I'm going to show you Soho and Chelsea in a little bit more detail. So this is the seven census tracts that comprise Soho. If you notice, most of the galleries are really clustered in the central area. The red line that bounds most of them, this is the area of the Cast Iron Historic District. It was designated in 1972, at which point there were two galleries in Soho. So the galleries followed the historic designation. These buildings are really something special. Here's an example of one. So the ground floor retail, this is still a gallery. This has been a gallery for quite a long time. So the cast iron buildings give a couple of advantages. For one thing, they allow very high ceilings, big open floor plans, lots and lots of windows. All of these are good for displaying art, right? So this has been documented before. The other thing is that if you are a gallerist and you show pieces of art, you probably care about aesthetics. If I care about aesthetics, I might want to have my gallery in a building like this because it's pretty. Right? But on the other side, if I were a developer thinking about opening, say, an Apple store or a room and board furniture store or a high-end wine bar, I might also want to have it in a beautiful building like this that people want to come into. Right? So the argument with Soho that I'm suggesting with this research is Soho had great buildings. That was likely to gentrify whether galleries moved in or not. Right? The galleries got there first, but if they hadn't, somebody else would have. Just a couple more pictures. So O.K. Harris is one of the star galleries that we note, has been in this location since the mid-70s. Really interesting and notable building. And this just gives you a sense of, you know, these are galleries also that sell art by artists you've heard of, which is not true for the vast majority of galleries, right? Even in Manhattan, they're mostly selling works by unknowns. You know, you can see also some of the architectural detail. The other thing, which you can't really see, but I kind of like, so this is a French Connection store. Directly across the street from the O.K. Harris is actually a Missoni store. So Soho is also now very high-end retail, and the galleries fit in very much with that. Chelsea, different picture altogether. So Chelsea was the most recent gallery neighborhood to emerge. If you look at the spatial patterns, sort of scattered all over the place, and you can just barely see there's a historic district down here and there's a historic district here. Galleries are not by and large clustered in the historic districts in Chelsea. These are primarily residential historic districts, and they've been residential for a long time, so they're kind of off limits. The big cluster of galleries is way over here off of 10th Street, which is, you know, kind of no man's land. This is miles away from the subway, or at least by Manhattan standards, miles from the subway. These are, in fact, directly underneath where the High Line Park is today, although the galleries predated the High Line Park. So I have yet to figure out what drove them to the far reaches of West Chelsea in the first place, but there's clearly a strong cluster over here. One thing that they do have is, again, sort of the building stock, big open industrial buildings that are good for showing art, but they don't look anything like they do in Soho, right? So this is the Gagosian Gallery. Larry Gagosian, probably many of you guys know, is one of the most famous art dealers. He has actually, at least at one point, had three galleries in Chelsea. You know, this is sort of, it was originally a garage. So you can see also lots of windows, lots of light, big open spaces, but not at all the same kind of aesthetic characteristics that you have of the cast iron buildings. There's another example. If this one hadn't had a tiny little sign on the window, which you can't really see, there's no way to know that this is a gallery, right? So this is a market that's not going to draw in casual passersby. You got to know that this is a gallery district to go there in the first place. Okay. How could galleries transform neighborhoods if we believe this story? So part of the problem doing this research in Manhattan is it's a really old, dense built stock. How do you change this if land values increase? So I look at a number of different ways the building stock can respond. Adaptive reuse is going to be the primary one. Some changes in external configuration, demolition and redevelopment. And I'll just show you some completely anecdotal evidence. So this is the block in Chelsea with the largest number of galleries as of 2000. So you can see there are 12 galleries in this one building. There are a bunch more galleries by 2003. During this time period, 2000 to 2003, a bunch of these buildings change use, so warehouse to loft, factory to museum, garage to loft, and so forth, in part because galleries are going in and reusing these spaces. The buildings aren't torn down. They're not replaced. They stay essentially the same in the exterior. It's just a change of use. In Midtown, we see also a couple of changes of use. This block in particular is interesting because there are two examples of redevelopment. So a six-story building torn down and replaced with a 16-story building, three adjacent lots, which are where the buildings are torn down, the lots are recombined, and you have a new building which is larger using the entire footprint. So things do change in Manhattan. Both of these I picked as the blocks that have really big concentrations of galleries. So this is what we would expect to see if galleries moving in do have spillovers and transform the neighborhood. I'll skip through those pictures. So when I put this stuff into a regression framework, if you do a really simple bivariate cut of this, neighborhoods with more galleries do experience more physical change, more buildings that undergo some sort of transformation, more adaptive reuse, increase in residential land share, increase in the total number of buildings. But as soon as I put in controls for the initial neighborhood amenities, those effects become statistically insignificant. So the bottom line with this is that galleries pick neighborhoods that have a lot of amenities. Those neighborhoods tend to change. The galleries, as best I can tell, do not have an independent effect on the neighborhoods, right? And so galleries seem to have, you know, a very good sense of this. There's some indication they're picking neighborhoods that maybe there's talk on the street that there's going to be some redevelopment, and they're going in and basically beating the curve but not causing it. So I want to finish with some policy implications, and I think there are a couple of lessons to take away from this. So one is, to the extent that there are local programs that are trying to attract more arts to a specific neighborhood, I think it's going to be really hard to get galleries to move to neighborhoods they don't already have an interest in. They really seem to need certain kinds of amenities, whether the quality of the building structure or access to cultural amenities and so forth. If those aren't present already, it's going to be hard to get them to go in. So this is not going to be a redevelopment strategy for low-income residential neighborhoods. It's just probably not going to work there. Because galleries don't seem to be price sensitive as much as shopping for amenities, rent subsidies are probably not going to be that effective without the combination of some other infrastructure there. And this is particularly true for unknown galleries who benefit enormously being in proximity to more established kinds of areas. New York is always a strange world. You have to give the caveat, can't extrapolate directly from this. I think it's actually hard to interpret what it's likely to look like in other cities. You know, on the one hand, it's really hard to do redevelopment in New York. Maybe other areas are going to be more responsive. They can change more. But on the other hand, New York has a concentration of galleries that no other city in the U.S. has, and particularly the star galleries that are likely to have the most impact. So in future research, I'm going to try to do some of this also in Southern California, but it's not clear to me whether the results will be substantially different. And then the final point is, you know, this is looking at galleries, which are for-profit businesses. They're interested in having access to consumers, most of the people who buy art are pretty well off, and so that kind of constrains the kinds of neighborhoods they're willing to go into. I don't think we can interpolate from this to what would happen with artist studios, artist residences, who may be more likely to be pioneers and go into neighborhoods where there's more room for improvement to begin with. And it's not clear to me that the spillover effects are necessarily the same between galleries, studios, or things like performing arts venues. And so I think this would have to be done with other kinds of venues in order to draw conclusions for that. Thank you.
I mean, I'm currently in federal service, but I've spent a lot of time at the local level and in private organizations trying to either redevelop and revitalize particular neighborhoods or develop an environment that is conducive to the kind of quality of life benefits that you guys have been documenting. And so I think your results are really intriguing, and there are a lot of important observations that that have come out of them. And I understand that you all spent a little bit of time together last night and talked a little bit about some of the cross-cutting themes that you saw in your own work, and I was wondering if you would want to comment with the audience on what some of those themes you know, presented for you in terms of your next steps and things like that. Would you like to start?
Sure.
Or Jenny? Okay.
Well, we had started discussing a bit about how some of the kind of more applied elements, like the town signaling or the community signaling, its concern or its seal of approval, had an impact in your work, and I noticed that in mine. Some of those kind of things like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think what was so interesting about Richard's work is that he really looked at the policy process, and Greg's work, I think the SCFD is an example of cultural development policy that's worked. I mean, it's been reapproved by voters twice. It's something that, you know, seven counties currently participate in it, and these are counties that are very different politically, and they come together and support this tax. And each county kind of remains their own kind of identity on how they want to distribute the funding. But yet there's this regional cooperation, which I think is something you also highlighted, the importance of cooperation and also the importance of cooperation between local government and arts organizations and advocacy organizations. And the SCFD is kind of a nice centralized agency that kind of supports that. And also that they do kind of provide support services for organizations that are in their infancy. They get support, you know, writing their grants because they have to come before county cultural councils every year to defend, you know, why they should get funding. It really, you know, motivates them to sharpen their grant writing skills, and staff at SCFD really helps with that as well. So it helps, you know, them then when they go out to get other grants and so forth, really attract more funding.
That was also one of the findings in Richard and Greg's work as well, as I remember. I felt like the incubator nature of the SCFD was very interesting and quite sort of resonated with the findings on the struggles of the smaller town arts organizations that you were finding in Massachusetts, Richard, and certainly something one observes working in, particularly in like neighborhood redevelopment, lower-income communities where you're trying to generate activity and recognize cultural assets that exist in those communities by developing events and, you know, trying to highlight things in different ways. I mean, it's really tough to get that stuff going.
So, I think one of the things we're thinking about down the road that Greg and I have talked about mm-hmm. is also, and this may impact yours as well, is that if certain communities apply for funding or for a zone or a grant or an economic district or an arts district, you know, how many of those can you have in the same place? You know, if somebody says, oh, I want that too, and then the other person says, well, let me put that tax thing in my place, and, well, how come I got left out? I'll put it in my place. And you know, so are we just sometimes, are we moving things around? So the question, that I think is a real concern, and we used to joke that if we're kind of encouraging artists to kind of move into this area, you know, they're coming from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So what if that other place then applies for funding to get them back?
So, but I think that
so
really,
what are we moving the deck chairs around the Titanic? I don't know.
It really goes to
doing?
The heart of, you know,
it's
whether or not
there's
increasing returns.
About
though.
That in the CDBG regulations. I don't know whether anybody else is geeky enough to know that in this room, but you're not allowed to poach using federal money.
But I think this really goes to the question of whether there are increasing returns, right?
Yeah.
Which is what we're really looking for.
Right.
So if there are increasing returns to having cultural clusters, to having a bunch of towns that have things, or a town having multiple kinds of activities, you know, or a region even developing sort of this arts infrastructure, and we see that certainly in the private sector too, in the art galleries. You know, there's a benefit to having a bunch of things close together because it encourages people to patronize that area, right? This is an arts district, that's why you go there, mm-hmm. and so you know, funding a couple of organizations to get them started may make it easier for the existing ones or for new places to come in, mm-hmm. right? And so this is, you know, that's what we're hoping exists. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that your research also pointed out was just the need to know your market. And I found as I was reading the papers that that was something that kept occurring to me again as sort of a redevelopment person. You know, you got to know who's going to come and buy the work or who's going to patronize the artists or patronize the festival. And really developing a strategy around that, you know, is incredibly important. And I didn't know whether either in Denver and Massachusetts, the arts program itself played a role in brokering some of these strategies, or were they completely responsive to what came in from the
arts program in terms of
The public program that was supporting the grantees? I mean, did they develop an opinion over time about how, you know, the market
I think
might function?
In the Massachusetts case is that, you know, they looked for the local community to kind of get a little idea going, but then they moved in to kind of help them sharpen it and to try to focus it and say, well, this might work a little better. How could you put this together and how would you structure that? So I do think that we've talked about the local piece a lot today, and I think it was local projects and local ideas, but I think they were aided and supported in kind of getting it together because they've never done it before.
Right.
You know, so they don't know whether they've picked a really good idea or maybe mm-hmm. something that's never worked before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know in the SCFD, one thing, again, because the different counties can kind of have, kind of decide how they want to funnel their money, one county decided, well, I really want to encourage collaborations between arts organizations. And so they kind of developed a specific grant that they were awarding that then art groups came together to compete on performances that they would collaborate on. So you had, you know, a salsa dancing company with an art gallery come together and try. And it really boosted, you know, audience attendance because you had, you know, audience members from both groups come together and just created a lot of exciting activity in some smaller communities in Colorado.
Interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to address this to Lauren. So I'm just wondering about other things that might have been you know, happening here. You've got this incredible metropolitan area that is booming from tons of immigration, mm-hmm. young people and high-tech entrepreneurs from California. And I think that, you know, that's a sort of independent thing that's happening in the same period of time mm-hmm. and could really help explain, you know, the sort of additional money that was. And also I thought in the comparison group that you used, which are these other counties in Colorado, which don't have that same, you know, propulsive growth with a particular kind of constituency moving in, I think that those aren't really, for quasi-experimental design, they're not a real good test case. I think you could find some other metropolitan areas who might be, or you could find some other areas who could be, but I'm just questioning that. So isn't part of the story of this add-on amount come, you know, from just a larger phenomenon that's happening and not just the cultural district alone?
Well, yeah, of course, it's not just the cultural district alone. I mean, to speak to the experimental nature of it, for example, Colorado Springs is not in the district. A lot of people are moving. I mean, that's a huge, huge metropolitan area in Colorado. They also have a huge arts community that rivals, really, a lot of the arts communities within the SCFD. The mountain towns, Aspen, Vail, Telluride, they have really booming arts festivals every year, film festivals. So there is, I would argue, you know, some interesting, you know, but again, because this is only a cross section, we can't look at changes over time. We can't really dig into that nature of the question. But I think being able to kind of look at just a snapshot in time, okay, well, this, you know, it started in 1989. I'm looking at 2005. What's happened? And I'm comparing small arts organizations outside the district with small arts organizations in the district, and I'm seeing that the ones in the district have more earned revenues and more total revenue. So, I mean, take it or leave it. I agree. It could, you know, it needs to be, the findings could be more robust and definitely need to be investigated further. I think it's hard to know, you know, what's attracting people to Denver. I think it is a lot of it is the mountains and all these kinds of resources. I think knowing that, you know, there is a vibrant arts community there retains a lot of people. I think once people come to Colorado and they find that, okay, it's not just the mountains and the skiing, but there's also this vibrant arts community that enhances the quality of life, people are more likely to stay. And so I think that's one thing about it as well.
Sir? I'll work it down the...
Professor Maloney raised the term intermediary organizations, and there was also discussion by the Harvard professor, a keynote speaker at lunch, about density as a factor. And then the influence of star galleries on other galleries in the mm-hmm. area. I wondered if the panelists might reflect on the importance of intermediary organizations, councils, associations, associations of gallery owners, groups of volunteers who are rooting for arts advocacy, and their impact on the likelihood of successful development.
On the gallery side, I don't think there are formal intermediary organizations. So there obviously are business groups. The gallery community is pretty small and pretty tight, and so the owners know one another and they interact with one another. To a certain extent, they're competing. They want to establish kind of a reputation for the neighborhood, but there's not sort of a formal association that allows them, you know, to brand and market collectively. There are neighborhood associations in New York that do some of that. So some of the story behind Chelsea with the High Line, the gallery owners were there, and here's this sort of, you know, blighted, unused rail track. And so the gallery owners were in part influential in pushing for there to be public funding for this. And, you know, the opening of the High Line has just been amazing for that neighborhood. And there's been a tremendous amount of residential development, new development that's gone in since the High Line started. So, you know, so the gallery owners may have been kind of the beginning pulling in for public funding, and then it leads to other things down the line. But I think those were sort of ad hoc relationships.
I want to speak to the importance of intermediaries, Richard. I know that came out of your paper.
Yeah. It's a great question because we see it so clearly in the art world, you know. But I don't know whether opera would not function if it didn't have its service organization or, you know, or Dance USA or, you know, if they were missing their service organization. But what I saw is not unlike other economic development efforts, is that there was an intermediary role, and in some places it was played by the town if they were trusted and people worked with them. In some places it was played by the local arts service organization. And like I said, it formed a very important function of gathering people together, managing the funds, kind of serving as a point person in this very diverse group of people that are not used to working together. They needed that assistance. I don't know if that's needed by every industry, you know, like I said, opera will probably do fine, you know, on its own. But in this case, that was the role that it played. And the interesting thing for me was, is that the town could do it if they wanted to, or this other separate organization could take on that role if they wanted to do it. And if the if that institution was weak, the partnership really suffered. So now, to what, one thing like I struggle with is, you know, there are limits to the things that I've discovered. You know, which one of my four factors are the most important? What if one factor is below a certain strength? Does that throw everything out of the water? Being qualitative, it's really hard to determine that. But I saw that when the town is weak, it suffers. When the intermediary organization is weak, everything suffers. But that's as far as I can go, I think.
Okay. There are two questions here, and then one back here, and another one over here. Let's start.
These papers were all great, and I have questions for each one, but I'm going to use my inside knowledge as being a resident of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to ask Richard a question. So I was particularly interested in you put up the relationship between population of the area mm-hmm. and receiving a grant, and I know that the population to have a member of the House of Representatives, or whatever it's called, in the Massachusetts legislature, it's about 35,000. So if you're 20,000, you got no grant. If you're 40,000, you got one. If you're 60, you got a couple of representatives. So that raises the obvious sort of political economy angle. And I wonder if you've looked at, I also know that the funding of the Massachusetts Cultural Council has been highly volatile,
yes,
up and down. And so that's a concern, naturally, for the agency. And I wonder if you've looked at all at the any evidence of change in voting records or voting positions of the representatives following receipt of an Adams grant for their community.
I'd first like to respond to that by saying that the only people that are allowed to ask questions have the word assistant professor in front of their name. Nobody to, no full professors. No, I have not looked at any of the voting data on that regard. We did see that, you know, that the smaller towns did not apply. So, you know, they weren't being restricted, or they didn't lose. They just didn't apply. And the larger towns did apply. So whether there was a political process beyond that, I know that it's a peer-reviewed process, like an artistic grant. You know, it's a bunch of people get together in a room at the MCC. They vote on the proposals. It's a traditional, like, you know, a peer review panel. So I don't, again, trying to keep the politics out of that. And the funding has grown. 2011-2012 pulled back. But between 5 and 10, the funding went up every year for these, and the grants seemed to grow over time. So I don't think anybody was pulled back from funding. Nobody lost, you know, there was an increase in funding all the way through 2010.
Okay, I'm being told we have time for one more question. So I know you'll defer. Okay.
Did somebody done that? And
you, sir, we're next. I'm sorry. We'll get you in the break.
Okay. Just a quick question for Jenny. You described four agglomerations of art galleries in Manhattan, and a couple of them have really emerged in the last couple of decades. Obviously, the marginal gallery has the incentive to enter where there's an existing cluster. What's the process that gives rise? What's the catalytic event that gives rise to a new cluster of galleries?
That is a really good question, and I don't have an answer to that. I can look a little bit in my data because I have the locations of galleries over time. You know, and Soho starts out in 1970. Soho has no galleries, and you know, then there's sort of one, and then there's two, and they trickle. You know, my sense is that the growth of the neighborhoods is a little bit different. You know, going back to, you know, the 1940s and late 1940s and 50s, when the Upper East Side and Midtown first developed, you know, there were stronger ties to some of the cultural institutions, and essentially they were chasing the money. That's where, you know, rich people live, rich people shop. That's where you have the market where you can sell art. You know, Soho, the story is that the artists were there first and the galleries followed the artists because they have personal relationships. There weren't many artists living in Chelsea. There was nobody living west of 10th Street at the time that they moved there. Somebody has suggested to me that tearing down the remnants of the West Side Highway made it feasible for that to be a more commercial neighborhood. You have other investments there, so Chelsea Piers goes in. The city was working on the extension of Hudson River Park. So, you know, it's not clear to me that there is one catalyst. It happens over a period of several years. You know, there clearly are some pioneering organizations, and those do tend to be the established galleries because they can afford to strike out on their own and do something new. And once you get sort of a critical mass of the established galleries, then this becomes attractive for other people as well. But that would really take sort of an individual case study to pull out.
So I think we actually have an audience member volunteering an answer to the question. You're on the spot, Marielena.
I know this one.
So can we have a follow-on? Yeah. Oh, nice. And that's it. That's it. We're going to have to go.
The art was being stored there. Those warehouses stored the art. And so that's why Chelsea began to emerge, because it cut moving costs.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Marielena.
It was brilliant. Looking for new warehouse space, larger space for larger work. I actually had a warehouse space there, so that is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Starting in 1995, I had no warehouse space.
Okay.
And essentially, all the blue chip galleries were looking for a larger space that they were exhibiting larger works of art. Yeah.
Although the interesting thing is, so Chelsea has, you know, certainly some big spaces. Not all the galleries in Chelsea show big spaces. So for some galleries, that's really important. And then for other galleries, it's the fact that there are already galleries there.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everyone for a very lively and intriguing set of findings.